Welcome back to Camera Conversations with your host Colin Campbell, and today is episode 214 of the podcast, and I'm joined in conversation by Dr. Meg J. Meg is a clinical psychologist and the author of a number of books. In particular, we discuss in this episode The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. A lot of Meg's work focuses on navigating and thriving during your youth, and this conversation is one that has so much value. You can expect to learn why your 20s aren't the most stress-free decade of your life, what critical events take place during your 20s, and what these can mean for shaping your future, on why 30 is not the new 20, despite what some in the media may tell you. You will also hear about a number of concepts that I think you will love, including the importance of building identity capital, what role weak ties can play in shaping your life, how to be more introspective and know what you truly want in your life. Meg brings so much wisdom to the conversation, and you're going to hear in my voice just how much I enjoyed hosting this episode too. I do not say this lightly when I say that this conversation has been one of the most valuable and insightful and packed full of lessons that I've had in the last 3 and a bit years of podcasting. We know the cool stat I often share that the show has now grown to the top 1% in the world, and it's hitting those top charts in the globe. But this is a top 1% of podcasts of insights. I'm telling you right now, there's so much for it. And even if you're not somebody that's in your 20s and in your defining decade, you can still apply much of what is able to be learned in this conversation to your life and move things in a positive direction. And I think that's one of the big goals of when I started this podcast. Now, there's no sponsor in today's episode. All I'm going to ask you to do is make sure that you're subscribed or following on whatever platform you're listening on. And if you're using Apple Podcasts or Spotify, make sure you've hit that 5-star rating button. It is a massive, massive help. And last but not least, one of the number one ways the show has grown to where it's gotten to, and I'm able to have conversations with individuals as clever and well-researched and wise as Meg, is people like you sharing episodes with other people just like you and growing the audience to a size that truly matters and can have an impact. So I'm going to ask you to copy and paste the link into a group chat, into a conversation with a friend. Whoever needs to hear this, please do pass it on to them. We do grow one sincere recommendation at a time, and I do thoroughly appreciate it. Now, the music's about to play, and you've got just over 50 minutes with myself and Dr. Meg J. Meg, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Colin. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And I was saying to you before we hit record, there's so much that we could discuss about the defining decade. But before we do that, you wrote primarily about 20-somethings. I want to go to Meg J in her 20s and what was life like back then to kind of set the scene before we go into all the different insights that you're going to be able to share with us today.
Oh, lordy. I didn't know we were going to start there. All right. Meg J in her 20s, I think, without knowing it, spent most of the time getting some good identity capital, which I know we'll talk about later. I'd never heard of the term, but I had a sense of the concept that I should probably get out there and make good use of my time and do some things that would lead to the next thing, whatever that was. So I was, kind of spent my time doing that, but also in a way that was interesting and adventurous for me. My first 5 years after college, I was an Outward Bound instructor. I don't know if you know what that is, but so I was taking people up rivers and mountains and the whole nine yards, and which was really great experience for me leading into grad school. And then I went to grad school, blah, 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 whatever. So I guess I would say I spent my 20s, doing some things right. Of course, I did some things, I don't know about wrong, but things I would do differently next time. But, I was like most people in their 20s trying to figure it out.
We've got Outward Bound in Scotland, in the UK, and I know that was maybe perhaps an area of passion that you worked in. And I know you've spoken about this before in terms of perhaps you may be accumulating experience and connections through an area that's maybe not necessarily the final thing that you'll end up doing, which for you was clearly a clinical psychology. But I wonder, when you decided to go and work as an Outward Bound instructor post your first round of college, what was maybe pulling you towards that, or what was pushing you towards that?
Yeah, I think like a lot of college grads, I was burned out. I had worked hard in college. I was burned out. I thought I probably wanted to go to grad school, but to go straight from college to, PhD is typically a good 7 years. To sign up for 7 more years of school straight out of college just did not feel like the thing for me. You know, I think also this is in the era before flexible work or work from home, just also parachuting into 50 hours a week at a desk didn't seem that exciting or that, you know, sort of growth oriented either. So I think Outward Bound felt like a way to do what a lot of people want to do in their 20s, and that's explore and grow and see the world. But it was also an opportunity to develop some skills that I really needed in terms of like leadership and self-sufficiency and self-directedness and working with groups. And so it, even though it didn't have anything directly to do with what I did next, was I went to get a PhD at Berkeley, which is not an easy program to get into. But perhaps counterintuitively, my whole Outward Bound thing really helped because it made me more interesting than your average student who had just been like cranking out, you know, research assistantships.
Through the general education system and the general internships that come with that, you maybe had a point of difference on your CV to differentiate beyond the grades that you had as well. And I know from hearing you speak previously and reading your work that in your Outward Bound role, you were actually working with like quite specialist populations within that as well. And yep. I suppose that probably links to the skill level that you've now developed as a psychologist in terms of being able to identify, oh, this person is from this particular background. They might have these particular needs or worldviews or cultural norms that I will need to understand and appreciate in order to communicate on their level.
Yeah, well, you've done your homework, Colin. I like that in a podcast host. They don't all do it, by the way, but yes, exactly. So I was living, like literally living with, camping with, you know, eating mac and cheese next to a bonfire with special populations, whether they were adjudicated youth or Vietnam vets or survivors of violence. So I learned a lot, you know, about, like you said, their worldview and their experiences, and not just some chapter I read in a book somewhere, but I was really living with special populations, and it taught me a lot.
How did that shape what you wanted to do when it came to practicing within psychology? Because of course you had almost 7 years to go in terms of attaining your PhD, but did it, were there any thoughts that were registering that were perhaps directing where you might go next?
You know, I had never, there really wasn't such a thing as specializing in 20 somethings when I was in grad school. I mean, I would like to say I was one of the first people that was like, here's an idea.
You're the front runner. you're the front runner.
Yeah, this huge group of people that need a whole lot and would like a whole lot of help. Why don't we focus on them? So, that wasn't a thing. So I wasn't really thinking about that. But I think one thing, it was almost like a precursor to me writing books, was that I have always found that on the one hand, like direct service with individuals is very meaningful and very important. On the other hand, it's so, for lack of a better word, inefficient. You know, I can help one person in 1 hour or 10 people on one group. And then you kind of feel like, gosh, but there's so many other people out there. This is just a drop in the bucket. And that I get frustrated about that quickly. So that was kind of why I started to write books, was feeling like direct service is kind of where the passion comes from, where I get up on my soapbox about stuff, why I really care. But then I care so much that I get frustrated about only being able to help the people who can like personally get to my office. So that's where all the books came from.
I've had some really interesting conversations in recent weeks about the pros and the cons of technology and how it can have some downsides. And my 200th episode, I had an investor on the podcast, and he was kind of speaking almost in defense of capitalism and the stock market in terms of what it's enabled us to create. So for example, the great companies of the world have created this StreamYard platform and this microphone and the distribution platforms like Anchor and Spotify.
Yeah,
that allow us to do these things. And if I'm thinking about from your perspective, you have a passion for supporting people, helping people, enabling them. If you couldn't, of course, the written press is a lot older, but nowadays the modern press is podcasting. It's YouTube. That's where it's distributed. If you look at your TED Talk, the millions of people you were able to reach through that would not have been possible if it weren't for the technology that we have. Of course, we can bemoan the fact that sometimes my phone distracts me more than I want it to, or I'm not as present as I should be, and that is a huge challenge that we're all fighting against with our kind of chimp brains that haven't quite evolved to deal with what we've got. But the upsides of it are so big when you and I can have this conversation, and 3 years into me podcasting, I can speak to guests like yourself through a quick email introduction, and we make this happen, and thousands of people are impacted positively off the back of an hour that you and I get to spend together. So there's huge impact to that. And I'm really glad that we do have these tools, and that through your book, through your YouTube series, through your podcast appearances, you can share this knowledge that you would perhaps only be sharing one-to-one.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a writer at heart, so I love blue jeans, t-shirt, laptop, written page. I mean, that's like what I love to do, but I've got to hand it to podcasts and TikTok and, you know, a lot of other technologies that make it so that people either just go with what they hear on that or go pick up the book because of that. And I've actually thought several times in my acknowledgement sections on my book, I should acknowledge Google, because I've written 4 books without ever going into a library and with a lot of research in the background. And I won't get into the weeds, but you know, there's Google Scholar, which is kind of the whole other vertical where it's all the research papers that we used to have to go, you know, into these like library stacks and like Xerox the articles and highlight the spots. I mean, I can sit in my coffee shop and, you know, have a book with 70 pages of references and never once go into a library. And that's pretty cool, having all that access.
It's very empowering when we use it in the right ways. And I think consciously using the technology we have access to is a real superpower nowadays, rather than perhaps being guided otherwise. And I'm sure we'll touch on social media as this conversation goes. And I know that you yourself actually stay clear of socials in terms of being super active on there, which I think maybe tells its own story. But when you did your TED talk, I guess it kind of links in really nicely with your book, The Defining Decade, because you said that 30 is not the new 20, which was almost like the media phrase around that time in particular. People were talking about that. What do you think the media have got wrong when they use phrases like that?
You know, it was kind of big at the time. People were like, oh my God, 30 is the new 20. And I think, you know, what is correct about that is all those so-called adult milestones, like figuring out career and settling down and picking a city and buying a house and finding a partner. All that stuff's happening more around 30 now than like in the 70s when it happened more around 20, which by the way, was before my time. So I'm, you know, also a modern day 20 something who didn't do all that stuff really till around 30. So if from a milestone perspective, sure, 30 is the new 20. But what happens when we tell people that, especially young people, is they hear like, oh, I don't have to think about any of that stuff until I'm 30. And then what happens is you miss this amazing opportunity to get in front of everything that's coming and lay the foundation so that when you do, you know, make those choices or set down those stakes, you're able to do it in a way that you feel good about. And so it's kind of a missed opportunity when we say 30 is the new 20, then people think what they do in their 20s doesn't matter. It matters whether you think it does or not. It's still what you chose or didn't choose to do.
I completely agree. And one of the things that I've been trying to rally against is people living their life on autopilot and maybe just doing the things that they're expected to do. And one of the questions that I don't write down lots and lots before a podcast, but one of the things that I definitely wrote down I wanted to say to you was that I know that as we get older, life almost moves quicker because there's less novelty and there's less changes. So you've got the same commute to work, you've got the same routine in terms of pick the kids up from this preschool or whatever happens. And when you're younger in your 20s, you probably have more opportunities for more experiences, like spending 5 years working as an outdoor instructor, like studying for your PhD and studying different topics. Whereas when you start your day job, you're much more likely to be doing similar things very, very regularly over a long period, and things do blend together. So I really am on board with what you're saying in terms of don't let your 20s pass by unconsciously, because I think that's a real danger nowadays. And I will bring in that technology aspect where you could just sit and scroll TikTok for 3 hours after work and then log back
where did my 20s go?
I think it's terrifying, and that's one thing that I really want to snap people away from. And the kind of people that choose to listen to a podcast about self-development for an hour every single week, they're already rallying against it by voting away from it. However, there are so many people out there that maybe are drifting, and I love that your message is very much these years still count, like whether you like it or not, or you feel like, oh, I'm going to hit some of these big milestones like buying a house or getting married or having my first child. later. That's cool. But don't feel like you haven't lived during this period, which really does count.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that what the general cultural hope is that people think, oh, if I do these things later, I'll do them better, you know, because I'll have more experience and I'll be more mature and I'll know myself better and I'll know the world better. And it's like, well, I guess that depends on what you do in your 20s. So doing it later isn't necessarily doing it better. It depends on, you know, doing it later because you spent 10 years on TikTok is not going to help you choose a better partner or, you know yourself or the world better. So I'm all for people, you know, having their milestones happen at a time that's good for them. And if later is better, great. But I want, you know, later to really be better because of the experiences they had in their 20s.
I think, as I said, the kind of people that listen to a conversation like this are predisposed to understand that they're laying the foundations for what's to come. So let's put in the groundwork now. And if you use like an investing analogy, if I'm investing now, then the tens or hundreds or thousands of pounds that I'm putting in will compound, and compound interest is like the kind of eighth wonder of the world, isn't it, in terms of
and it's the same with, you know, developing work skills and personal development. It's absolutely the same thing. Like the small things you do in your 20s have the biggest payoff in the end, and it's a lot easier to, like, you know, create the life you want through small moves in your 20s than having to do these like big wide swings in your 30s or 40s, which, as to your, you were saying earlier, are harder to do once you're sort of more, you know, kind of settled in a particular identity or place or job or family.
And particular responsibilities like family, as you said there. Given the reach of that TED Talk, and I know you said you wanted to take your message wider than just the one-to-one, what kind of responsibility do you feel when it's seen by so many eyes and ears and it maybe reaches so many people?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, 10 years after it first came out, I mean, I think at the time it was very overwhelming because I am used to working with people one-on-one. And so I know who my people are. Like, I know who I'm speaking to and who is, you know, kind of in a good place to hear what I'm saying and who may not be in a good place to hear what I'm saying, in which case I maybe don't say it. You don't have that control over your message when it's just posted on the internet or when it's a book or if it's a song you write or a podcast you do. So it can be pretty stressful. You might have had that experience yourself of feeling like, I'm saying these things, but I don't know the millions of people who are hearing it and how they're reacting. And so I definitely, you know, gave the talk to help people, not to like hurt people or upset people, but you sort of realize you lose control over, you know, who all's hearing it and what their reactions were. So, I mean, I think at first that was a little overwhelming. I went from helping, you know, one person at a time, or maybe 300 people in my classroom, to, you know, a million in the first week that the talk went up. So that was a bit overwhelming. But now that it's been 10 years and I've got, you know, sort of the wisdom of experience and hindsight, I mean, I can see that it's helped so many people. And I'm sure there's people out there who don't like it, don't want to hear it. That's fine. But there have just been millions and millions of people who it has helped. And I think that's what you have to hold on to.
The comment section is overwhelmingly positive, and the depth of positivity is so strong in terms of like, this was exactly what I needed to hear at this point in my life, or reflecting back on my life, I've watched this back for the third time.
Oh, cool. I don't look at the comment section, so thanks for telling me that.
Yes, but the only other thing I would add is, of course, what drives people to comment or email or write to somebody is a strength of emotion. So you get the strong positives, but then you get the strong negatives because they are compelled to make a complaint or an answer or submit something forward as well. In the same way, like, restaurant reviews are actually not always the best way to judge a restaurant, because if you go on, we have in the UK TripAdvisor, and you look at this restaurant, you get all the people being like, food was amazing, service was amazing. But then, of course, you get the 5 stars, but you get the 1 stars because they're the people that were the most triggered to make a response. Whereas the people that are somewhere in the middle, they're not moved enough.
Good. I know. And I have heard some complaints, you know, some directly winding up in my email over the years. But I think that's where sort of the 10 years of the positive has outweighed the negative. by a mile. So I don't, you know, now I'm kind of maybe old enough or experienced enough. I don't take it personally. Like you can't, nothing's for everyone. So, you know.
You also can't caveat your message for everyone, Megan. And that's something that I've really learned over the last 3 years. You can't caveat every single sentence you say to apply to everyone's particular situation. And you were speaking to that there when you were saying you gave your talk to help people. Now, of course, there might be people who just are not in a place to hear that they need to live as intentionally as possible and try and build up as much identity capital and try and explore the things that they know are true about themselves that they should do and the things that we'll definitely discuss in the next few minutes that we've got together. But there's going to be people listening to that are just like, oh, this just doesn't apply to me right now. I've got such a terrible situation. And that's fine, but you can't address and flower all your language around that. Otherwise, you speak to nobody. Right. And controversially enough, one of the people that's the most well-known people on the planet now is Andrew Tate, because he speaks so directly and he doesn't caveat his message whatsoever. So there's no ambiguity about what he's saying. So people either love him or they hate him, and because they understand his message. And in the same way, when you've spoken on that talk or you've written in your book, you're speaking to people who are at a time in their life when they're ready to hear that, or they're teetering on the edge and they read that and they think, brilliant, that was what I needed. And that's so much more important for me. And I guess that's the positivity of you being willing to put yourself out there without fear or favor.
Yeah. Well, you know, I learned when I was actually, this is for your business minded folks out there. When I was first going into private practice, like many people, my attitude was I'll do anything. I'll see anybody. And a very wise supervisor said, no, don't do that, because then no one will send you anybody, because they don't know, like, well, what do you do? And like, what are you really good at? And like, what's your niche? And that ironically, the more you're willing to specialize and say, I do this one thing, I do it super well, you're going to get all of that thing. And you just will, and you're willing to give up all the other things. And so it was sort of the second that I said, I'm a 20 something specialist. That's what I do. Don't send me anybody who's 16. Don't send me anybody who's 40. I'm a 20 something specialist. I'm willing to let go of everybody else. But then every 20 something on earth is like, you know, wants to be my client. So it sort of all works out. So I think, you know, not being afraid to have a clear message for a clear group of people. And it's okay if you don't try to speak to everybody. It's better not to.
Certainly. You can't serve everyone. If you try and serve everyone, you've got to serve a particular population with your expertise. And that's what you've built up as well. And I know we were speaking about the importance of the time in your 20s. And one of the stats that you shared is around 85% of our most consequential decisions happen during that period. Mm-hmm. What are some of those that stand out?
Yeah, so it's what we were talking about, that by around age 35, we have probably figured out where we're going to settle geographically. Statistically speaking, you've probably met or are living with or have partnered with your partner. You're probably settled into a particular career direction by then. A terrifying fun fact for you is that your average 20-something has 9 jobs by the age of 35. But by the time they're 35, that's usually kind of coalesced into something. So by the time we're 35, we generally have defined, you know, identity, place, partnership, career. And then, of course, you can reinvent and reinvent and reinvent from then on, but you kind of have to start with what you've come up with by around that time.
There's some sort of base to go off. And yeah, I do think you maybe see, and this is an interesting one, maybe somebody who's been married really, really young at 35, if things maybe went wrong and you got divorced, you might see a radical reinvention, because they might move city or move job or move career, because they're almost, and I had a gentleman called Sahil Bloom on the podcast, he talked about like destroying your old self and like a rebirth,
right?
And I can certainly understand that, but for the majority of people, which is what we're obviously speaking to, at 35 they'll have made some of these big fundamental decisions and fundamental choices that are shaping the relative path they could go down in the future, in terms of them being small iterations to the previous versions they've already lived.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other cool thing about that research is that it shows that, and this goes back to your point of that people in their 20s don't know or don't realize that their 20s are so consequential, is that a lot of those defining jobs, relationships, conversations, podcasts, things that they that happened that really ended up shaping people's like ultimate life trajectories, they didn't realize they were significant at the time. And so it's only sort of you look back and you're like, holy cow, you know, that's true that most of the people that had the biggest influence on my life or the events or the places or the jobs or the schooling, like most of that stuff goes down before you're 35.
That links quite nicely into one of the topics I was really keen to talk about, which is one of your chapters is called the Strength of Weak Ties. Mm-hmm. And it almost flies in the face of logic because we have the classic self-development aphorism of you are the average of the five people you spend most time with, which I think definitely has its place.
Sure.
But this is almost like a separate lesson
yeah.
to the side of that, which relates to those kind of contacts that maybe aren't like your closest friends or your relationship, but there's somebody that's a little bit further afield.
Yeah. So the Strength of Weak Ties is not my concept. It's Mark Gronovater, Stanford. He wrote a paper about it, about social networks, like 30 years before Mark Zuckerberg was ever born. And there was a thing like a social network online. But anyway, he was interested in how weak ties, so people we don't know very well, people we see twice a year or that we bumped into on the street 5 years ago and then we just saw in the coffee shop and just happened to talk to, how they have an impact on our lives. And actually, weak ties are our most transformative figure. So they're the people most likely to change our lives because they're the people who have new ideas, new information, new contacts, new perspectives. We have new conversations with them. So, you know, the five people that we're hanging out with all the time are incredibly important and formative and supportive, but we already know what they think. We've heard it all. You know, there's a bit, it can be a bit of like an echo chamber going on there. And you think you're out of ideas or out of options. And then you bump into someone you haven't seen in 2 years and you start talking to them and they go, hey, have you thought about calling, you know, such and such or so-and-so? And then suddenly your life can really go off into a new direction. So weak ties are, you know, tend to be our most transformative figures. And it can be a challenge for 20 somethings to get out there and talk to people, not just that they don't know well, but people who are older, you know, by 5 or 10 years or, you know, that they don't think that has any reason to talk to them, that that's hard for people. But the 20 somethings who get out and kind of talk to weak ties open themselves up to so many more opportunities and ideas.
I consider myself to be good at networking and I consider it to be one of my skills. Of course, my day job is in sales and then I podcast and I've grown this kind of accidental behemoth, which is amazing and I love it. But the network you build from that is incredible. But the network you build from maybe friends of guests or the audience of the guest, if they've got a social media profile that they share the show on, you tap into their audience, you build weak ties in that regard, and they might say to you, oh, you interviewed Dr. Meg J, I love her stuff, have you heard of this particular author? And I'll be like, no,
right,
and I'll go and check them out, and then they'll be a future guest in the podcast. But one of the immediate examples that sprung to mind for me was, and I know you talk about this, is the number of employment opportunities that open up from your weak ties as well, because there may be people that are slightly outside of the bubble right. of career that you've been in for such a long time, and you might bump into somebody, like you said, that you maybe met at a party 5 years ago, you then meet them at a coffee shop down the line, and you bump into them and you're like, oh, what was it you did again? Oh, you do this. Oh, wow, I didn't know you did that. Yeah. My friend such and such is right. looking for somebody that's a graphic exactly. designer.
Actually, I've gotten so many emails over the years that said, oh my gosh, I read The Defining Decade, and then I was, you know, selling my bike and someone came over to buy it and we started talking and then their company had a position that was exactly what I was looking for. Like that was sort of this, how that was all working suddenly made sense to them. I mean, it is how the world goes round. I mean, I'm on your podcast today because I was on your friend's lovely podcast. Love that guy. So when you reached out to me, I was like, yeah, okay, sure. Why not? I mean, this is how the world works, just having these little connections of like, okay, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, for the audience, that's David McIntosh, who's a fellow Scottish podcaster, and there's probably four other podcasters that I would call I guest share with, so we kind of share contact details if the guest is a relevant fit right. for their audience and the style of podcast they want to achieve, which of course you absolutely were, Meg, in that regard. And sometimes I've actually been asked before, like, oh, why would you do that with a fellow podcaster? Is that not potentially sabotaging your listens, your downloads? And I was thinking, no, come from a place of abundance. And like, David's introduced me to Dr. Meg. I've introduced him to Adam Lane Smith, for argument's sake. And people are like, oh, that's amazing. Like that's so cool, because you're building like a connection with these other guests through that, and then their week ties beyond that. I really like the process, and I think for those the thousands of listeners that don't have a podcast that are listening, there's so many other ways you can do that beyond introducing podcast guests. It's just building that network out and giving yourself the opportunity to have a wider network. And even though these people maybe aren't your best friend, being brave enough to go and talk to them, understand more about them, bring curiosity to the conversation, and goodness knows what will come next.
Well, that's really, I mean, I like some of the words you just used of braveness, curiosity, also feedback is another one. Is that I, one thing I've definitely gotten better at over the years is I'm very interested in feedback always. And like, even now, you know, I'm working on a book right now. And, you know, when you choose your editor, sometimes people will advise you, just get an editor that'll leave you alone. You know what you're doing. And I'm like, no, I don't want a yes man. I don't want somebody just to say, you do you. I want somebody that's going to like push back or make other suggestions. And I mean, that's really kind of what weak ties do for us, is that they're not us. And so they see things differently. And so they're able, if we're, you know, kind of brave enough to get out there and say, this is what I'm working on, or this is what I'm looking for. Curious about what other people think, and then we're willing to listen to what they suggest that we do, that can have a real transformative impact.
You're right. Because they're not so close to the action in the day-to-day, they can sometimes give a better suggestion or judgment of that. And definitely, if somebody, like, I have a lot of weak ties that maybe listen to this on a weekly basis, and they'll say, oh, Colin, you spoke really well on this topic. And I'm thinking, oh, did I? Like, that was like 9, 10 weeks ago. I don't even remember what I was saying at that point, but maybe I did. Maybe I should do something around that for my email list, or maybe I should do that as a course, right, or maybe I should present that to my audience. And the people that are slightly detached from it, who aren't in the thick of it with you like every single day, are better able to sometimes make those judgments.
Yeah, or they'll ask questions that, so I don't really like talking about books that I'm working on, but I've learned that I have to do that, because it, you know, you kind of practice putting your thoughts into words or getting the ideas out there. And sometimes people have reactions and you're like, oh, you thought I meant that? Or it helps you sort of see other people's perspectives while you can still use them.
One of the greatest hacks that I've found is when I explain a concept on here, it helps me relearn the lesson. So if you're maybe talking about a particular chapter in a book to somebody, and albeit you maybe didn't want to do that, when you verbalize it, you maybe go back to writing the next day and you're like, I need to say it just how I said it there, because that was what resonated. That's what hit the spot as well. And speaking of things that hit the spot that you've written, I really, really enjoyed when you spoke about unthought knowns, because I think when we were talking about my fear of people living life on autopilot and maybe just wishing away their 20s and chasing down this, oh, when I'm older, I'll be able to do X, Y, or Z. You are encouraging an element of introspection that can be a little bit challenging for somebody to do initially, because some of the answers they might find might not be immediately what they want to hear, or what their ego or what their upbringing or what their circumstances have told them. So please do share for the listener what you mean by that.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've talked a little bit about identity capital. That's like the things you go and you do that add value to yourself. We've talked about weak ties. So another concept, probably the one that follows it in the book, is unthought known. And part of that is actually around me helping 20-somethings understand, you know more than you think you do, because they'll say like, I don't have any identity capital. I don't have any weak ties. And I'm like, nope, can't be true. Not possible. You just don't realize it. Like, you have not reflected on, and this is normal developmentally. This is not a criticism. It's just normal that people come through college or they go get their first job and they're like, I didn't learn anything. And so I say, nope, not possible. You know more than you think you do. You got more capital than you realize. I mean, let's at least figure out what you got and then move on to the next thing. So I think sometimes slowing people down and helping them, you know, realize what they know. They just haven't consciously brought it into their mind as like things that they own around what are my strengths, you know, what are my qualities, what are the things that interest me, what are the things I get excited about. Sometimes, I mean, people, I mean, unless you're like a psychology major, or you've, you know, done a lot of self-improvement, people just haven't had the occasion to do that. So it's the concept is the unthought known, which are things that are true about people that they kind of know somewhere deep down, but it hasn't made it up into conscious thought. And this often happens with weak ties. People, actually, I give an example in the book, which I won't go into because it'll eat all our time. But when I was first writing a proposal for the Defining Decade, and then I needed to get it somehow to someone in New York. And I was like, oh, poor me. I know no one in the publishing industry. And then I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it and realized I actually did know somebody. And it was just like a random email story. You got to read the Defining Decade to get the story. But, and then I emailed her and that got the ball rolling, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, everybody has capital, whether they know it or not. Everybody has preferences or strengths or interests. You know, people will say, I don't know anything about what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I'm like, no, you know something. So let's figure out like what that is and start there and pay attention to what else you're learning.
The way that you use identity capital is one of my favorite ways of illustrating it, because it is exactly that. It's like a bank balance that you've almost accumulated and built up over time. It's that capital that's sitting there, and it comes from work experience, life experience, it's sports experience, whatever it is.
And yeah. And no one can take it away from you. No one can take it away from you. So it's not like a job that you have or lose, or it is yours once you've owned it. No one can take it away from you. So it's just a matter of how do you keep building on it or reinvesting it or, you know, work diversifying it.
If we were to be really prescriptive for the listener as well, and like kind of draw an example, I'm thinking about you were saying at the campfire and the outward bounds with different special populations. So I think it was Vietnam veterans was one of the groups that you mentioned. By learning how to communicate with them, best believe you probably learned some skills to break down a conversation with a 20 something who came in who maybe exhibited similar symptoms or similar personality traits. Of course, they hadn't been serving in Vietnam because they're in their 20s, mm-hmm. but they maybe have something else about them that you thought, you know, when I had that conversation when I was 23 in this particular job, mm-hmm. I thought like this. And it won't be as immediately obvious as that, but that skill will be there. In the same way, when I was thinking about things that I want to do post-university doing a politics degree, I was thinking, right, what have I built up skills doing? I've taken vast amounts of information and distilled it down into something that's understandable. I've written arguments. I've positioned them. I've mm-hmm. spoken publicly. I've not been afraid to stand up in a tutorial when 80% of the room disagree with my political views and I disagree with theirs, and we're going to have a difficult conversation. So I've faced rejection of my ideas as well. So if I did a debating competition and I said, oh, the motion was this house is in favor of capital punishment or whatever it was, you face rejection from the audience. So I ended up working in sales because I'm a good communicator. I can take information that's expert to me, mm-hmm. but the market needs to understand it. So I need to distill it down to the buyer so they are confident in the decision they're making. And I'm also not afraid of rejection, and I can mm-hmm. speak at length, as people will see from this. I'm happy to do it. I'm quite verbose. But those were only things that were not obvious to me, but I was thinking, like, what capital have I banked, if I'm thinking in your phrases, that might lead me to be a valuable employee?
Right.
And it's those.
Right, exactly. And so it's actually in the updated edition of the Defining Decade, there's a reader's guide in the back now, because people were, you know, emailing and saying, oh, this is a great book club book or a classroom book. You know, this, do you have a reader's guide? And I didn't. So I added one for the updated edition. And one of the questions in the back just asks people to take some time and like make a list of what are the pieces of identity capital that you earned from your last job or your last degree. Because a lot of times we just haven't taken the time to articulate that in our own minds. So we can't exactly, you know, articulate it to other people.
They really are unknown at that point, mm-hmm. because they haven't explored them. So you can't say what you don't know.
Right.
So by taking the time out, and this is something that has come up continually with guests, sometimes there's inertia when you want to write about yourself or think about yourself. And I know when I first started journaling probably near the start, the same time I started the podcast, I sometimes didn't like the things that I was writing about myself if I was maybe answering journal prompts. And you're like, oh God, like, do I think that about myself? And it's only by working through that you can then maybe build a new self-image or a new identity, or maybe you see some of the things that you write start to show up as patterns and you think, so if I'm giving an example about the kind of transferable skills into sales, I'm writing things like, I am quite fearless on the phone. I am able to draft emails that make sense to a prospect and they know what I'm getting in touch about and they're not sure. And spoiler alert, a lot of the emails that I write to prospective podcast guests are very similar to what I write to prospective podcasts in work because I'm using prospective customers in work because I'm using a very similar approach. But sometimes there is a little bit of a scary barrier in terms of, if I write these things down about myself, I'm not going to like what I say. Mm. But you can't ever progress to the next stage, which is actioning the positive traits, if you don't do the hard part.
And you know what I would say it is, maybe even more, is, or what I see a lot, is a fear with 20-somethings, if they pick something, that they're limiting themselves. Like, oh, but if I say it's this, then it can't be that, or I've said it's this, I've like chosen something. It's like, whatever, you've chosen something for this conversation or this job application or, you know, this particular, and you get to choose again. Remember, I said you have 9 jobs by the time you're 35. You're going to get to choose these things again. But people will be like, well, I don't want to say I want to do this, because what if I want to do that? It's like, well, you just say that in 6 months or a year when you figured out that this didn't work out. But, you know, kind of being pushed right now, my son's in high school and he's doing college applications and his, you know, college counselor at school, you know, he's writing essays. I want to do this. I want to do that. And the counselor's really pushing him, like, why, you know, why do you want to do it? And what exactly do you want to learn? And it's just making him go deeper to like sort of have some, you know, unthought knowns come to the surface and like pick something, you know, versus like, this sounds cool, maybe this is it, but to really just sort of own something.
Doing things on a whim, sometimes an element of trusting your gut, but equally, if you can be a bit more explorative and answer the why question, that's always really, really helpful too. We've mentioned throughout this conversation that the first edition of The Defining Decade was, I think, 2012, you released it. Then you followed up down the line with a second edition. Something that happened in those intervening years is the explosion of social media in terms of usage. I think when you wrote the first time, there would have been a Facebook, but might have been restricted even at that point to like university graduates who maybe had the particular email addresses.
It had just gone wide. So really the defining decade, and I say this like sociologically, not as some sort of like go me comment, but was like one of the first places that this was written about, of that, because I saw it happen in real time where my clients would say, I'm going to join this thing called Facebook. And then they'd come in the next week and say, I hate my life. I'm so bummed out. I mean, it was just like, I saw it happen in real time. And this is before it had been written about. I mean, I'm, you know, kind of a research nerd. So I like to have research to back up the stuff that I say. And I, you know, there was barely any research out there. I mean, the data wasn't in, the studies were hardly being done when I wrote it in 2012. But studies aside, I saw it week after week of like what happened pretty much immediately when people joined social media. So, I mean, I'm not, you know, no judgment on social media. I think by now we all know it has upsides and it has downsides. And it's kind of up to us as adults to choose like how we're going to let it like play a role in our lives. But by the time the update came out in 2021, we had 10 years of data. And, you know, of course, Facebook is like yesterday's news. And then I talked about Instagram, but now, of course, it's TikTok. And, the bottom line is it doesn't really matter what the platform is. I mean, that's going to keep changing. It's more of what is your relationship with technology going to be? And like, how are you going to use it to be happier or healthier? Hopefully, rather than just kind of unconsciously let it suck all your time.
I think that's one of the big considerations, isn't it? Time spent, and how seriously do you take the element of comparison? And there's been times when I've rallied against the quote that comparison is the thief of joy, because I've used comparison to people I look up to through health and fitness, through sales, through podcasting to stimulate me. But I'm not maybe comparing my life to theirs because I'm aspiring to live elements of their life while knowing, of course, I might not live the exact same life as theirs. Now, that's a very conscious thing to do. Mm-hmm. But Sarah logging onto Facebook after a long day slaving away in a job she doesn't enjoy, logs onto Facebook and sees that the girl she went to school with is on holiday in the Maldives. Right. Of course it's horrible. Yeah. It's not fun, but that's when you've got to unplug and know what the stimulus is doing to you. So there's always a gap. There's like the stimulus, there's a gap, then there's the response. If you don't give yourself that gap and maybe make changes such as not going on the app when you're in a bad mood, or not going in the app unconsciously, or unfollowing or filtering your feed, whatever it is, mm-hmm. I'm a big advocate of that. And I think it's interesting how in those very early days where you were one of the first people to comment on the use of social media, now the lesson is roughly the same, albeit the platforms are different in terms of please don't let your time be spent frivolously using these apps. And I'm a huge advocate of the term like conscious use rather than unconscious use.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, really, the defining decade is at root a book about time. I'm very interested in time and how people think about time and how that impacts like the choices that they make. And so, you know, of course, young people have this sense of like, I have all the time in the world. So like, what does it matter whether I go get a job this year or in 5 years, or try to have kids, you know, in 5 years or 20 years, it doesn't matter. I have so much time. I mean, that's just kind of what happens when you do perceive. So part of the defining decade's job was to say like, you actually don't have as much time as you think you do. So like, let's create some urgency. But, you know, I think I'm not for or against social media. I am for people using it wisely and intentionally, but I definitely am against it sucking massive portions of people's day. And so, you know, I had a new client in my office yesterday. You know, one of my routine questions first time I meet them is like, okay, so tell me, how much are you on your phone every day? She goes, you want me to look? I was like, yep. So she, you know, pulls up her phone, pulls up screen time, 7 hours. That's standard. I mean, that's quite standard.
It's a lot, yeah.
Well, it's standard. And so, and then to say like, okay, so, but let's, what was the 7 hours? I mean, it wasn't all on TikTok, right? And so she was like, well, yeah, I check email for work and I look stuff up for my job. So it's not like it's all, you know, wasted time, but it does require that people do a gut check of like, wow, well, shoot, but that probably was about like 4 hours of social media. And there's a lot of other things I could do at that time. And so, you know, I'm kind of a time person, and that's usually where I focus it.
Speaking of time, Meg, I want to make the most of the time that we've got together. And I want to ask you about love and relationships in particular, because one of the phrases that you've used is happiness is more about who you marry than the college you attended. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, all the research says so, that if you had to pick the single biggest determinant of sort of health and happiness in people's life, if you had to just choose one based on the research, it would be relationships, the quality of people's relationships. And then kind of beyond that, like we've been talking about all along, career is really something that can be reinvented and reinvented and reinvented. And, you know, there can be some like, you know, costs and downsides to having to switch and reinvent and blah, blah. But I mean, it is generally what people do throughout adulthood. Relationships are harder to sort of get in and get out of without a lot of sort of internal turmoil and heartbreak. So, you know, most people on earth want to be loved. And most people say, you know, it'd be cool to find one person and to be like done with it. So, I mean, if that's what you're aiming for, then you're going out there and you're trying to make one decision that's going to have an enormous impact on the next, you know, 20, 30, 40 years of your life. And career is just never like that. I mean, you can always switch teams, switch jobs, you know, do something on the side. I mean, in relationships, I mean, I think are a little bit more sort of intimately tied to our health and happiness.
And I guess in terms of identity capital, you're accumulating that in career and different ones that you do, perhaps 9 up until the age of 35. In terms of relationships, can you accumulate identity capital or like lessons that you've learned from previous partners?
Well, that's what I mean, it's unfortunately not as concrete. So people sort of are like, there's nothing I can do to improve my chances of, like choosing well. So, well, I don't know about that. So, you may not have nine different relationships by the time you're 35, but you're probably gonna have more than one. So it is actually, I tell my clients and students, it is a lot like jobs, of that if you use those relationships wisely as like true learning opportunities, where you learn what works and you learn what doesn't work. And if you're in something that doesn't work, you go ahead and get on out of it rather than just like spend 3 more years because you don't want to like get a new couch or, face being alone, then that you do. So it's not really, relationship capital as much as it's just like true growth experiences. And so that's where, even if you don't want to get serious or settle down or choose a partner until 30 or 32 or 35 or like whatever your jam is, you can use the years before that to learn more and more so that you choose well. Or you can say like, well, it doesn't matter because I'm not settling down with any of these people, and you can just run around and learn all the same lessons over and over again and like not make great use of your time, which is sometimes what happens.
I heard you speak about one of your first clients, perhaps pseudonym Alex, who was dating like, almost down the dating hierarchy in terms of she was dating guys that she knew pretty much immediately that weren't probably right for her. They maybe weren't treating her particularly well as well. How important is it to be a bit more conscious of that in your 20s? Because I guess it maybe sets the tone to some extent.
At the time, my supervisor told me something that stuck with me forever, and it's that the best time to work on your marriage is before you have one. Meaning, start working on it before so that you choose well and all that. Because then once you choose, you're kind of in it, or you're in trying to get out of it. But anyway, I guess what I've seen is that in general, people do try to do a little bit better than the time before every time. Do you know what I'm saying? But what that means is your point of entry matters. Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying? Like if your first job out of college, if you get a little bit better with every job, but your first job out of college is like in the basement, you're only gonna, eventually climb so high. So I kind of encourage people to like shoot high from the get-go and like continue to imagine, like to really think about what do I want, what do I not want, and go straight for that rather than seeing each little relationship as a little better than the one before, which isn't exactly like ambitious growth, when it comes to such an important decision.
And I think perhaps controversially, it also dictates your social market value to some extent. If you're looking at, oh, this guy's always dated girls that are really, really troubled and terrible, and he always has terrible, explosive relationships, and like his back catalogue is a series of like really serious domestic incidents, that's bad. In the same way, if a girl has had hundreds of male partners and they're all like tattooed guys that have ended up in jail with like different gang signs on their face, like you're going to be like, oh, well, I probably don't want to date her. Or because that's what her past is. And that sounds really judgmental, but ultimately people, if they were really honest away from the confines of a microphone like I've just been, they would probably say like, oh, I do look at somebody's previous history, and if it's like a really worrying trend of people that they associate with, then I would be worried about being involved there.
I mean, in general, I think that with most 20 somethings, the bar, let me make sure I don't get this backwards. So the bar in terms of what's too bad, it is too high, and like the bar of what's too good is too low. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's like they get in easy, but they don't get out easy. Do you know what I mean? It's like the bar to get in is low, but the bar to get out is high. And
I remember this from your story with Alex. Like she was almost in this relationship that she knew wasn't right, but she needed something really bad to happen to leave. And you were being encouraged by your supervisor to realize, like, no, leave now and start trying to find something better immediately, because otherwise you are stuck in a situation where you know it's bad, but it's not bad enough that you're running away from it. It's not a domestic abuse case, but it's bad enough that you know you don't want to marry
Yeah,
this
you don't
person.
want.
Okay,
Well,
let's go.
yeah, so here's a good, I know we're running out of time, but a good way to think about, and this does, again, I'm a time-oriented person, and so this translates to both work and love and time, that ask yourself about your partner or your job, you know, do I want to be doing this in 5 years? And if the answer is no, you have to ask yourself, why am I doing it now? And how much longer am I going to spend on this? Because I think what happens with young adults, they know they don't want to do something forever, but in their mind, they've got like so much time, they'll just like waste 5 more years in a job or a relationship that they know they don't want. But it's kind of like, why not? So the question I often ask my clients, maybe they don't know what they do want, but I'll say, well, do you want this job in 5 years? Do you want this relationship in 5 years? No. Then, okay, well, then when are we going to get out of it? What are we waiting for?
That's a great question and a really nice way for us to wrap up, Megan. I'm so grateful for your time. And I've mentioned during this podcast that you're not a big person on social media. You don't like showing up. You've got an old inactive Twitter that I found, though. I was doing some research on there.
Yeah. I of course, my publicist people have, you know, gnashing their teeth that I'm not like constantly trying to sell myself on social media. I'm not interested in being a famous person. I'm interested in people reading my books or hearing what I have to say for their benefit. So to tell you the truth, you know what I love? I do enjoy going on podcasts. I love other people talking about my work. I love people talking about it on TikTok. That's really been great because I think people can talk to each other about it. And I'm not like trying to sell myself. I guess I'm just not really into that, me personally, but I am for the whole world talking about it.
I love it, Meg. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to link your website in the show notes for people to keep up to date. And of course, they can head towards Amazon or any good book sale website to find your books. And I'll be back to speak to the listeners again very, very soon.